Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now in Zechariah chapter 11, which I will entitle The Flock Doomed to Slaughter. We will see that in this chapter, this is referring to Israel being doomed by the Romans in AD 70, at least according to the majority opinion, which I happen to hold to. Zechariah is prophesying after the completion of the temple, which was completed in 516 B.C. Nobody knows exactly when he prophesied after that, so let's just say around 500 or so. It doesn't really matter. We begin now in Zechariah 11, verses 1 through 3. Zechariah begins, "Open your doors, O Lebanon, that a fire may feed on your cedars. Wail, O Cyprus, for the cedar has fallen, because the glorious trees have been destroyed. Wail, O oaks of Bashan, for the impenetrable forest has come down. There is a sound of the shepherd's wail, for their glory is ruined. There is a sound of the young lion's roar, for the pride of the Jordan is ruined." Now, verses 1 through 3 are a prediction of the downfall of the leaders of Israel, and I am going to say that happened in AD 70. Now, a little bit of introduction here. There's a change of theme in Zechariah. Zechariah is now talking of messianic times, whereas previously he was primarily talking about the Golden Age, most probably. The Golden Age being defined as that time between the approach of Ezra to Jerusalem as Ezra comes back from Babylon, 458. He did that, and then all the way up until the time of the arrival of the Seleucid Emperor, Antiochus Epiphanes IV, he arrived in Jerusalem in 168, created all kinds of havoc. That was the end of the Golden Age. So in that time, we have lots of events as described in the first chapters of Zechariah, but now that Golden Age is now over. Now there's more talk of corrupt religious leadership who don't care for the flock, and this corresponds with the rise of the Hasmoneans who follow the Maccabees. The Maccabees began their revolt against the Seleucid Empire in 164 BC, and they carried on the fight down to about 130 BC, and the Hasmonean dynasty started in 140 BC and lasted till 37 BC when the Romans knocked it out. And if you know anything about the Hasmonean dynasty, there were lots of corrupt leaders, bad stuff going on during that time. Now, Zechariah is probably talking about more than that. He probably includes the evil religious leadership in Jesus' times, and we'll see that as we go through. Now, these three trees that are mentioned in verses 1 through 3, cedars, they fell, cypress has been destroyed, oaks of Bashan, they've come down. Some people say that these three types of trees represent the evil leaders of Israel. Eugene H. Merrill says so. We'll look at that a little bit later, too. It could just be a poetic metaphor for strong trees falling, just like the strong nation of Israel fell. Trees falling gives a good picture of the fall of a nation. In verse 1, Zechariah says, "Open your doors, O Lebanon." A couple of options as to what he means by that. Option number 1. This could refer to the doors of the temple, which were made of cedar, and cedars came from Lebanon. So, open your doors, O Lebanon, meaning O trees of Lebanon, you temple doors, that a fire may feed on your cedars. So, this would be predicting the destruction of the temple in AD 70. This is John Gill's idea. Option number 2 as to what this phrase means, open your doors. It refers to the mountain passes between Lebanon and Israel. If you look at a map, you will see the Lebanon Range and the Anti-Lebanon Range with the two rivers of Lebanon in between, one flowing south, one flowing north, the Latani flowing south, the Orontes flowing north. If a Roman army wants to come down on Jerusalem, it has to go, doesn't have to, but it could go through those passes. Guzik says this is what's being referred to here. He says that the Roman armies came through those mountain passes in Lebanon to destroy Jerusalem in the Jewish War. Now, Guzik is not a preterist. He's a dispensationalist futurist, but I love it when he refers to AD 70. It warms my heart. Well, of those two options, I think option number 2 is the best. Open up your doors, O Lebanon passes, right between the two Lebanon mountain ranges, so that the fire may come down and burn up the cedars. And, of course, the temple is made out of cedars, so it gets burnt up. "Wail, O Cyprus, for the cedar has fallen." Some translations have for Cyprus fir, F-I-R, fir trees. A fir tree is much less noble and strong than the cedar tree. And the idea here is, if the cedar tree has gone down, well, so have the firs. If the strong tree goes down, the weaker tree is going to go down a fortiori. We could say the same thing about the oaks of Bashan, too. They are lesser trees than the cedars, so if the cedars go down, then the oaks of Bashan go down. And let me repeat, Eugene Merrill, the Old Testament professor at Dallas Seminary for so many years, he says these three types of trees refer to the noblemen and leaders of Israel. Well, with cedars, cypress, and oaks, Jerusalem is compared to a dense forest which is getting ready to be destroyed, and that's the main point. Now, the oaks of Bashan are mentioned in verse 2 as one of the three types of trees that is going to be destroyed. John Gill says that these oaks refer to men of power and authority, so he has the same idea as Merrill, or it could just be it's a poetic figure of strength that's being felled. Bashan is to the east of the Sea of Galilee. Wikipedia says that the Golan Heights are the western part of Bashan. I've got a little interesting war story to say here. I saw the Golan Heights looking at the Golan Heights from the west to the east, facing the hills there. It's a famous part of Israel. And years later, I was teaching in Shantou, China, and there was a professor there who got married on the other side of that hill. He and her husband were living near us in an apartment, and she showed us slides of their wedding, and I wasn't interested in the wedding so much, but I looked at all the scenery around, because they had a lot of outdoor activities, and I saw, oh, that's what the other side of the Golan Heights looks like in the land of Jordan. It's a lot more arid, clumps of dry grass and sand, whereas on the Israeli side it was more green. In verse 3, we see that young lions are roaring. Why are they roaring? For the pride of the Jordan is ruined. What is a pride? A pride is a thicket. The Holman Christian Study Bible translates that as the thickets of the Jordan. The thickets on the bank in which the lions reposed. They were ripped up by the Romans, and thus the lions are upset. Assuming that this is referring to AD 70, which I believe it is. We go now to Zechariah 11, verses 4 through 5. Thus says the Lord my God, Zechariah continues, pasture the flock doomed to slaughter. Those who buy them slay them and go unpunished. And each of those who sell them says, blessed be the Lord, for I have become rich. And their own shepherds have no pity on them. So Zechariah is quoting Yahweh's words to Zechariah. Zechariah is told by Yahweh to pasture the flock doomed to slaughter. Pasture also means to feed the flock. The word pastor comes from pasture, to feed, because a pastor is supposed to feed the flock, not fleece the flock. Now, because Zechariah is pasturing the flock doomed to slaughter, he is said to be a type of Christ. The Cambridge commentator says so, Colin Delitzsch says so, the pulpit commentary says so, Barnes says so, and Benson says so. Here's what Colin Delitzsch says. The prophet does not come forward here as performing these acts in his own person, but that he represents another, which in truth neither Zechariah nor any other prophet ever did, but only God through his Son. Well, since there's so much unanimity on this point, we will take it as true that Zechariah is representing Jesus the Messiah. Now we have a question of exactly what does it mean to pasture the flock doomed to slaughter? What does the verb pasture mean? Option number one, Zechariah is acting this out by actually feeding a flock of sheep. Prophets like to use object lessons, and this option says that Zechariah went out, found some sheep, and fed them while he was giving his prophecy. Somehow, I don't think that's true. Second option is, what does Zechariah mean, or what does Yahweh mean when he speaks to Zechariah and says, pasture the flock? The meaning is that Zechariah is to prophesy to the flock, because when you prophesy to the flock, you're taking care of the flock. But I think the best option is option number three. Pasture the flock was probably done internally in Zechariah's mind. Now, Eugene H. Merrill, the aforesaid Old Testament scholar at Dallas Seminary, takes this view, and so does Colin Delitzsch. And once Zechariah saw the vision in his mind, he then communicated to his hearers what he had done in his mind. In favor of this argument is verse 8 in Zechariah 11. Zechariah says there, then I annihilated the three shepherds in 1 month. Well, now, Zechariah is not going to physically annihilate three shepherds. So we assume that was done in his mind. So I think Merrill and Colin Delitzsch have got a good argument there. Now, who is this flock doomed to slaughter? Here are some options from my commentators. Option number one from Barnes. The flock doomed to slaughter is the wicked Jews in general, all of them. Godly Jews, ungodly Jews at the time of Jesus. Option number two, the flock doomed to slaughter, is the little flock of the followers of Jesus. They're doomed to slaughter because they were persecuted by the Jews after Jesus was crucified. I don't believe that. Option number three, the flock doomed to slaughter is the whole of the human race. I don't believe that either. Colin Delitzsch denied that. Option number four, Colin Delitzsch affirmed this option, and so does the pulpit commentary. They say that the flock doomed to slaughter is the nation of Israel. Colin Delitzsch say this is held by a majority of commentators, and since I'm so rarely in a majority, I'm going to adopt this view. Now, here are some options as to which particular time the nation of Israel was slaughtered as a flock doomed to slaughter. Here's what Poole says. The Israelites were a flock of slaughter to the Egyptians, the Chaldeans, etc., afterward to the Romans, who ruined their commonwealth, slew their citizens, and burnt their city. So Poole just includes all the disasters that fell on Israel. I would say that it's probably AD 70 when the Romans did their thing with the Jews. Poole at least includes that. Benson says that the nation of Israel was a flock doomed to slaughter right before the destruction of AD 70. In fact, in Jesus' time, the Jews, according to Benson, were slaughtered by their false shepherds. Sort of a metaphorical use of slaughter. Option number three. Barnes says that Israel was a flock doomed to slaughter because Israel was destroyed by the Romans in AD 70, and I think that's the correct option here. You will notice as we go through, when I go through all these options, AD 70 always seems to be an option. And so the cumulative effect of all that is to make me think that Zechariah is talking about AD 70 here. In verse 5, Zechariah 11, Zechariah says, those who by them, the spiritual leadership that oppressed the people and murdered the Messiah, they're basically buying the Jews and selling them into slavery. That would be metaphorical. They were selling the Jews into the slavery of idolatry. Or you could say they were selling them into slavery to Rome, because that's what happened after the Jewish War in AD 70. Scadzillions of Jews were sold into slavery. We go down to Zechariah 11, verse 6. Yahweh is still speaking to Zechariah, and Yahweh says, for I shall no longer have pity on the inhabitants of the land, declares the Lord. But behold, I shall cause the men to fall, each into another's power and into the power of his king. And they will strike the land, and I shall not deliver them from their power. Now, when is it that God will no longer have compassion on the inhabitants of the land? I think it's when the Romans destroyed Israel in AD 70. Joseph Benson, John Gill, and Matthew Poole all agree with me. That word land there, of course, ha'aretz, the land, that could be the earth, and in fact, the pulpit commentary says it should be the earth. Well, if that's so, then God will be punishing those who oppressed Israel. I don't think that's what Zechariah is getting at. He's referring to the punishment of Israel as it becomes apostate leading up to what happened in AD 70. Now, at the end of verse 6, Yahweh says he will turn everyone over to his neighbor. Now, the commentators tend to agree on this. They say this refers to the factions and divisions among the Jews during the siege of Jerusalem. You will recall from Josephus there were three major factions in Jerusalem fighting each other. Multitudes fell into the hands of the heads of each of these parties and perished by them. So there was a lot of killing going on inside of Jerusalem. Joseph Benson quotes one of his commentators, Blaney, who says this, nor can words more aptly describe the calamities which befell the Jews in the war which ended in the taking of Jerusalem by the Romans, when the people, having first, by their intestine broils, destroyed one another, as is set forth at large by Josephus, at length fell into the hand of him whom they had owned for their sovereign, in other words, the Roman general. And then Blaney, quoted by Benson, quotes John 19:15, we have no king but Caesar. Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown say that the Zealots and other factious Jews expelled and slew one another by turns at the last invasion by Rome. Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown say that this is what is being referred to here by Zechariah. When Zechariah says in verse 6, chapter 11, I will turn everyone over to his neighbor. Also in verse 6, Yahweh turns everyone over to his king. Well, who is the Jews' king? Well, that would be the Roman emperor, as John Gill and Matthew Poole say, the Jews having declared that they had no king but Caesar. And so sure enough, Vespasian and then Titus, two successive Roman emperors later on, took control of Jerusalem. And so God did turn the Jews over to their king, their emperor. We read in John 19:15, this is the mob in Jerusalem, they therefore cried out, "Away with him, away with Jesus, away with him, crucify him." Pilate said to them, "Shall I crucify your king?" The chief priest answered, "We have no king but Caesar." And that's what happened. Caesar became their king, and they became a pile of rubble. Gill even narrows it down and says the Pacific emperor is Vespasian. Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown says it's either Vespasian or Titus. Vespasian started the siege of Rome in the Jewish War between 66 and 70. He had to leave to go take care of a civil war in Rome during the year of four emperors, and he turned the siege over to his son Titus. Titus later became emperor when Vespasian died. Now in verse 6, Zechariah says, or Yahweh says through Zechariah, they will devastate the land. Who does the "they" refer to? It refers to those neighbors, those factions. They ruined Israel by refusing to surrender to the Romans and by fighting each other and killing each other. We go now to Zechariah 11, verse 7. Zechariah now takes up the narration and he says, "So I shepherded the flock intended for slaughter, the afflicted of the flock. I took two staffs, calling one favor and the other union, and I shepherded the flock." Now this flock intended for slaughter, we've decided, the majority view is just referring to Israel in general, both believers and non-believers, and Yahweh. But here in verse 7, the flock is shepherded, and the afflicted of the flock is shepherded. And so we need to ask, who are these afflicted of the flock? John Gill says, the afflicted of the flock are the elect Christians who are a subset of the doomed flock of Israel, the flock intended or doomed for slaughter. Another translation, by the way, is the poor of the flock, the afflicted of the flock. So it sounds like Zechariah is shepherding both the whole flock and the afflicted of the flock because they were mixed together in Israel. So Zechariah takes two staffs, two shepherd staffs. He called one favor. As Montgomery Boyce says, favor stands for the favored status of Israel as the chosen people of God. And then he took up another staff called union. And Montgomery Boyce says that union there stands for the internal harmony of the people that was lost at the time of the siege of Jerusalem. One more commentator that says this passage, or these passages, refer to the siege of Jerusalem. Another translation of union is bands, B-A-N-D-S, but union is better, I think. So we have two staffs, one favor, one union, good stuff. It's not going to last, though. We go now to Zechariah 11, verse 8. Zechariah is speaking. He says, "Then I annihilated the three shepherds in 1 month, for my soul was impatient with them, and their soul also was weary of me." Now, who are these three shepherds? There have been many speculations, little unanimity of opinion. So I'm going to read you a bunch of speculations, and then I'm going to save what I believe the most likely speculation to be for the very last. I've got seven speculations. Option number one, the three shepherds were three sects among the Jews. John Gill says the three sects were the Pharisees, the Sadducees, and the Essenes. Well, some commentators substitute the Herodians for the Essenes. Some substitute the high priest for the Essenes. Barnes says the three sects were priests, judges, and lawyers. Benson mentions as an option the three sects were priests, scribes, and elders. Well, that's such a diversity of opinion. That option means nothing to me. Option number two, this is from Montgomery Boyce. The three shepherds that are going to be annihilated are the prophets, priests, and kings of Israel. Barnes quotes Theodoret and Cyril, early church fathers, as backing that view. Prophets, priests, and kings. Now that makes a little more sense than the three sects among the Jews, option one, because it's well known that Israel was led by prophets, priests, and kings. And so I will give that a possibility. Option number three, the last kings of Judah, the last three kings of Judah before the Babylonian exile. This is from Eugene H. Merrill. These last three kings were Jehoiakim, 609 to 598, Jehoiachin, 598 to 597, Zedekiah, 597 to 586. Now, these three kings are annihilated in 1 month, according to Zechariah, chapter 11, verse 8, the verse we're on. But I just gave you about 11 years of Jewish royalty, so you have to take that 1 month if you hold to that option. You have to take that 1 month as representing a short period of time, relatively speaking. And even though apparently Eugene H. Merrill was a dispensationalist, or is a dispensationalist because he taught at Dallas, he doesn't take that 1 month literally as dispensationalists are wont to do. Well, here's option number four as to who the three shepherds are. Zechariah, Shalom, and some third usurper unknown to history. Zechariah and Shalom are kings of the northern 10 tribes of Israel. I'm not going to read you about them. But let me read you how Colin Delitzsch disses that view. They say, the attempts of rationalistic commentators to prove that the three shepherds are three kings of the kingdom of the 10 tribes have completely broken down, inasmuch as of the kings Zechariah, Shalom, and Menachem, Shalom alone reigned an entire month, so that not even the ungrammatical explanation of Hitzig to the effect that, a Hebrew phrase here, refers to the reign of these three kings and not to their destruction, furnishes a sufficient loophole. Whilst Maurer, Bleak, Ewald, and Bunsen felt driven to invent a third king or usurper in order to carry out their view. In other words, this is speculation upon speculation. Mess with the Hebrew a little bit, and you come up with nothing. We're going to ditch that option. It's not three kings of northern Israel. Cambridge mentions another theory, Antiochus Epiphanes IV, Antiochus Eupator, and Demetrius I in the time of the Maccabees. I don't think so. Colin Delitzsch give as an option number six. Option number six, the rulers of three empires. Now, which three empires? Colin Delitzsch don't say. So you can see that of those first six options, the only one I'm going to give any credence to is prophets, priests, and kings represent the three shepherds who are going to be destroyed, or who were destroyed by Zechariah in his vision. Well, here's option number seven. This is from Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown. The three shepherds are John, Simon, and Eleazar, three leaders of the three factions in the Jewish war, the three factions I've already mentioned. And so that would fit nicely with our view so far that this chapter deals with AD 70 and the destruction of Israel by the Romans. We go now to Zechariah 11, verse 9. Then I, that would be Zechariah, then I said, I will not pasture you. What is to die, let it die. And what is to be annihilated, let it be annihilated. And let those who are left eat one another's flesh. Well, once again, we have a reference to the siege of Jerusalem by the Romans in AD 70. Benson agrees with me on that. Poole agrees with me, and so does the pulpit commentary. Why would the people be dying and annihilated and eating one another's flesh? Because that's what happened, as Josephus records. Even Guzik, the futurist dispensationalist, says that this eating one another's flesh literally refers to people eating one another during AD 70. The pulpit commentator says, many see here a reference to the awful scenes enacted when Jerusalem was besieged by the Romans and intestine feuds filled the city with bloodshed and added to the horrors of famine. Now, I did find a comment by Merrill who said that the eating of one another's flesh refers to cannibalism at the siege by Babylon in 586, and I'm sure it happened then too, but that's not what's being talked about here. Zechariah is more of a prophet than an historian. 586 is a long time before Zechariah. We go now to Zechariah 11, verses 10 through 11. Yahweh is speaking now and says, and I took my staff, favor, that's capital F, favor. The staff was named favor, as you will recall, and cut it in pieces to break my covenant which I had made with all the peoples. So it was broken on that day, and thus the afflicted of the flock who were watching me realized that it was the word of the Lord. Now, the first thing we have to look at in verse 10 is who the I is. I took my staff. One might think that's Zechariah, but we'll see that in the same sentence, the person who's speaking says, he cut the staff into pieces to break my covenant. And the Young's Literal Translation for I there has my staff. So it's Yahweh that's speaking. And, of course, I have the question, how does Yahweh cut the staff in pieces? And, of course, none of my commentators address the issue. I imagine this is in a vision, and so somehow Zechariah saw the staff cut in half. I know he wasn't looking at God, but somehow the staff was broken. What does that signify? Well, that could refer to the change of covenants from the old to the new covenant. Fred Miller, John Gill, Joseph Benson all hold that view. Remember, Jesus said in Matthew 21, verse 43, therefore I say to you, the kingdom of God will be taken away from you and be given to a nation producing the fruit of it. Now, this covenant with all the peoples that Yahweh had made, who were the peoples? Option number one, all the tribes of Israel. Fred Miller, Joseph Benson, the Cambridge Commentary mentions it as an option, and Matthew Poole all say this is what is being referred to here. This, of course, is in distinction with the afflicted of the flock mentioned in verse 11. The afflicted of the flock, the covenant stayed intact for them, according to Matthew Poole, but for all the rest of Israel, the covenant was broken. Now, the other option, or one other option, is that the peoples are the peoples of the earth, of the world, and God had made a covenant with all the nations of the world in favor of Israel, that they would not attack and harm Israel. Barnes holds this view. The Cambridge Commentary mentions it as an option. Colin Delitzsch affirmed this view. And, of course, God broke that covenant when he said, okay, go get them. Go get the Israelites in 586 when he let the Babylonians come in. As Guzik said, the covenant was broken when the peoples attacked Israel. Now, Colin Delitzsch, in support of this view, say that this idea of God making a covenant with the peoples is analogous to the treaty God made with the beast, mentioned in Hosea 2, verse 18. On that day I will make a covenant for them with the wild animals, the birds of the sky, and the creatures that crawl on the ground. The third option, as to who the peoples are, is the believing remnant of people. According to this view, the translation of people should be people. So I will break my covenant which I made with all the people, i.e. the believing remnant, just with the elect remnant of Israel, as Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown say. Either I misunderstood that option or else I have a hard time believing it. Why would God be breaking his covenant with those who believe in him? So I'm going to toss that option. So is it with the tribes of Israel that God is breaking his covenant because of their sin? Or is it with all the peoples of the earth that he's breaking his covenant so that they can attack Israel? Either way, Israel gets attacked. If God is breaking his covenant with Israel, his covenant to protect them as their liege lord, well, then Israel's going to get attacked. And if he's breaking his covenant with all the peoples in the world, the covenant that says that they will not attack Israel, if he breaks that covenant, they will attack Israel, and the end result is Israel gets attacked. So it doesn't really matter how you take it. The end result is the same. So it was broken on that day in verse 11, and thus the afflicted of the flock who were watching me realized that it was the word of the Lord. Now the afflicted of the flock, those of the flock who fear the Lord, the remnant in other words, they realized that Zechariah had spoken the word of the Lord. Now here are a couple of options as how they did realize that. I didn't get these from the commentaries. I didn't get these options from reading commentaries. These are my own ideas, so take them with a grain of salt. Perhaps the people were impressed by the object lesson. Now, of course, if this is a vision that Zechariah is seeing in his head, the people didn't actually see this. But if Zechariah later related this to the people would be impressed by that. The object lesson, you got a stick, it's called favor. Israel had shown favor, then the stick was broken. Oh, that's very impressive. We believe you now. It could be option number two as to why the people realized that Zechariah had spoken the truth was because of his reputation as a prophet. After all, he'd been given visions for quite a while. He's already had 8 night visions in one night. Very positive visions rebuild the temple. And so they're likely to believe Zechariah. We go now to Zechariah chapter 11, verses 12 through 13. And I said to them, Zechariah said to them, the contemptuous Jews, not the poor or afflicted remnant, but the unbelieving Jews, I said to them, if it is good in your sight, give me my wages, but if not, never mind. So they weighed out 30 shekels of silver as my wages. Then the Lord said to me, throw it to the potter, that magnificent price at which I was valued by them. So I took the 30 shekels of silver and threw them to the potter in the house of the Lord. Now Zechariah is still role-playing as a shepherd, and he wants his wages as a shepherd. Again, it's either in a vision or he actually went to the people and did all this. Now, he asked for 30 shekels. He said, if you want to pay me that, or just forget it and pay me nothing. Either way, whether they paid him or not, the point would be made that they value him not at all, because 30 shekels was the price of a slave. We read in Exodus 21, verse 32, if the ox gores a male or female slave, the owner shall give his or her master 30 shekels of silver, and the ox shall be stoned. And so this price of 30 shekels shows the haughty Jews their contempt of Zechariah. But if they decided not to pay him, they give him 0 shekels instead of 30 shekels, that would also be showing their haughty contempt of Zechariah. Verse 13, then the Lord said to me, throw it to the potter, that magnificent price. magnificent is obviously sarcastic, because 30 shekels is not literally magnificent. So throw the 30 shekels to the potter. He received the 30 shekels, and then he is to take the 30 shekels and throw it to the potter. And verse 13, at the end of the verse, says the potter is in the house of the Lord. Now, this is somewhat problematical. First of all, we've got to decide, did Zechariah actually do this? Did he actually take 30 shekels of silver and throw it to a potter in the house of the Lord? Or did he do it in his vision? Now, Albert Barnes says it's more probable that Zechariah did this in a vision. Let me quote from Barnes. Unlikely that Zechariah, at whose preaching Zerubbabel and Joshua and all the people set themselves earnestly to rebuild the temple, should have had so worthless a price offered to him, and the casting at price, which God condemned, into the house of God, at the command of God, and so implying God's acceptance of this. In other words, the people would not have treated Zechariah so contemptuously because of Zechariah's great reputation. And also, it looks like God is accepting all this. For after all, God told Zechariah to do this in the vision. Either in the vision or actually, God is behind it. If they did it actually, it would mean that the people would have to accept the fact that one of their beloved prophets is throwing 30 shekels into the temple in a contemptuous fashion. So I think Barnes is probably right. This is all in a vision in Zechariah's head. I'm not 100% sure, but it seems to me that that's probably what's happening here. Now we have the question of, who is this potter? Well, before we get into that, let's talk about how this verse is fulfilled in the New Testament. This, of course, is very famous, very well-known passage. We read in Matthew 26, verse 15, concerning Judas. And Judas said, "What are you," talking to the Jewish leaders, "willing to give me to deliver him up to you," to deliver Jesus up to the Jewish leaders? And they weighed out to him 30 pieces of silver. Now, the next question is, in the New Testament, how did the money end up in the potter's hands? Well, here's what happened. Judas, feeling guilty, threw down the money in the temple. The priest, after having picked up the money, could not put it in the temple treasury. They couldn't bear to do that because it was blood money being used to put Jesus to death. And money as the price of blood violated Jewish law. So because of their compunctions, they really worried about putting blood money in the treasury. They're not worried about killing the Son of God. That didn't seem to bother them too much. But at any rate, they wouldn't put the money in the treasury. And while they're deliberating, Judas goes out and hangs himself in a clay pit that belonged to a potter. The Jews then bought that pit with the 30 pieces of silver. And that's how the potter got the 30 pieces of silver, because potters would use the clay. That's why it's called the potter's field. They bought this piece of land. The location was made a community burial ground for indigent people. Some people have raised a problem with this story. If 30 shekels is such a cheap price, how could the Jews buy a whole field with it? The answer to that is the potter had dug the field up to use the clay, and so the field had no use left except as a graveyard. And then Judas hung himself so that his body disintegrated, and he fell from his noose into the potter's field, which was a graveyard, and he was buried where he fell. You have to take a couple of versions of the story and harmonize them there to get the whole story. So that's how it was fulfilled in the New Testament. Now let's go back to Zechariah and see, what does this mean? Zechariah throwing 30 shekels of silver into the potter who's in the house of the Lord. Well, I've got four options as to how to deal with that. Option number one, Zechariah was told to do this by Yahweh so that this action would be fulfilled exactly by Judas in the New Testament. This is Benson's idea. Zechariah gave the money to the temple leaders, who then went out and bought a potter's field, just like what happened in the New Testament. I find that unlikely myself. So let's go to option number two. This is from the Cambridge commentary. The potter was working in the temple, making cheap clay vessels for the temple service. They had to use clay vessels for a lot of things, bowls and such. Potters normally worked in the Valley of Hinnom, southwest of Jerusalem. According to Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown, there was a lot of clay there, and so they would get their clay from the Valley of Hinnom, and that valley was a symbol of pollution, judgment, and hell. It's called Gehenna in the New Testament, which is a perfect description of hell. Jesus used Gehenna to describe hell. Trash was later burned there. In olden times, there was child sacrifice given to the idol Molech that was done in that valley. And so this potter who worked with clay out of the Valley of Hinnom would be the perfect person to receive what was to be the symbol of blood money. Now assume the potter carried his vessels into the temple, and thus the potter was there to receive the 30 pieces of silver. Well, that's the Cambridge commentator's idea, and Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown, option number two. Now, here's option number three. This is from Colin Delitzsch in the Pulpit Commentary, and I think this is probably the best answer. Throw it to the potter is a proverbial expression, meaning contemptuous treatment. Although, as Colin Delitzsch admit, there is no way of tracing the origin of the expression, but they say that must be what it meant. So, thus, there would be no actual potter. The Pulpit Commentator says, quote, commentators usually consider the phrase as a proverbial expression for contemptuous treatment. So this seems to be not a one-off opinion by Colin Delitzsch, but a general idea in the college of commentators that are out there. So the verse would read, verse 13, throw it to the potter, throw the money in the temple contemptuously, that magnificent price at which I was valued by them. That makes a lot of sense to me. Here's option number four. Use a translation which gets rid of the word potter altogether. For example, the Bible in Basic English says, put them, the 32 pieces of silver, into the storehouse in the house of the Lord. Not give it to the potter, but give it to the storehouse. The New American Bible says, he threw them, the 32 pieces, into the treasury in the house of the Lord. Well, Colin Delitzsch doesn't like that maneuver. They say that ha Yotzer signifies the temporal treasury, and Yotzer is a secondary form or a copyist error for Yotzer, the Hebrew here with no vowels. I think that's also Yotzer. I really don't understand what they're saying, but basically what Colin Delitzsch is saying is that potter is close to storehouse, and there's either a copyist error or the word can be translated that way. But Colin Delitzsch say that is a mistaken attempt to solve the difficulty of who this potter is. So we're going to go with the proverbial expression option. Throw those 32 pieces of silver with contempt, that magnificent price. So Zechariah did that, and he threw them to the potter. He threw them contemptuously into the temple, into the house of the Lord. We go now to Zechariah 11, verse 14. Then I cut my second staff, union, in pieces to break the brotherhood between Judah and Israel. That I sounds an awful lot like Zechariah, but again, if we keep going with the flow, it would be Yahweh speaking. He cuts his second staff, union, in pieces, again in a vision. So this is what Zechariah sees. He sees the second staff being chopped to pieces to break the brotherhood between Judah and Israel. Now, this is the opposite of how Judah and Israel were supposed to be. We read in Ezekiel 37, verses 16 through 19, Son of man, speaking to Ezekiel, Yahweh is, take a single stick and write on it, belonging to Judah and the Israelites associated with him. Then take another stick and write on it, belonging to Joseph, the stick of Ephraim, that's the northern 10 tribes, and all the house of Israel, that's the northern 10 tribes associated with him. Then join them together into a single stick so that they become one in your hand. When your people ask you, won't you explain to us what you mean by these things? Tell them, this is what the Lord God says. I am going to take the stick of Joseph, which is in the hand of Ephraim, and the tribes of Israel associated with him, associated with Ephraim, in other words, the northern 10 tribes, and I'm going to put them together with the stick of Judah, the southern 2 tribes. I will make them into a single stick so that they become one in my hand. But now, in Zechariah 11, verse 14, that single stick is going to be broken to pieces, the opposite of what happened in Ezekiel 37. This is done in order to break the brotherhood. In verse 14, Zechariah 11, what does that mean? I've got four options. Option number one, break the brotherhood between Old Covenant Israel and New Covenant Israel. In other words, the Old Testament and the New Testament. The Old Testament nation of Israel and the New Testament Church of Christ. Fred Miller holds to that view. Colin Delitzsch denies it. Miller says that this prophecy is now in Messianic times. It might be objected to this, that the Messianic times is a time of restoration, not a time of breaking the brotherhood. That's negative. Miller answers that by saying Israel is the spiritual Israel, the church in New Covenant times. Judah is the old nation of Israel, which rejected the Messiah. So now there is no brotherhood between old and new Israel. And I guess it is unpleasant that the old covenant broke away from the new covenant, but whose fault was that? The Jews rejected Jesus the Messiah. That's option one. Here's option two. This is held to by Matthew Poole in the Pulpit Commentary. The brotherhood between Israel and Judah was broken by the factions present in Israel that appeared right after Christ appeared and before AD 70. There were always factions in Israel. The Sadducees, the Pharisees, the Herodians, the Essenes. Option number three, Israel was broken apart by the Romans in AD 70. Guzik holds to that, and he's a futurist dispensationalist. Barnes holds that, Benson holds that, and I think I do too, because that fits in with the context of this whole chapter, as I've been pointing out as we go through. There's so many indications that AD 70 is being spoken of. So this breaking of the brotherhood was fulfilled when Israel was scattered by the Romans after their rejection of their shepherd Jesus, after Israel did that. So how exactly are Judah and Israel broken apart? How is their brotherhood broken? Well, the answer is simple. Judah and Israel were blown apart when the nation was destroyed. Option number four as to what this breaking of the brotherhood between Judah and Israel is. Option number four says that that breaking is the breaking of the bond of union between Judah and Israel's 10 tribes under Rehoboam. Rehoboam, of course, was the king that took over Judah after Solomon died, and he had the northern 10 tribes break away from him in 931 under Jeroboam the first. And of course, that was a huge breaking of brotherhood between Judah and Israel. Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown holds to this. They say this breaking of brotherhood mentioned in Zechariah 11:14 represents the fratricidal discord which raged within Jerusalem before it fell. But the problem with that is, why would Zechariah be looking backward in time? I think Zechariah is more of a prophet than an historian. So I'm going to go with option number two, that the breaking of brotherhood, which was symbolized by the breaking of the union staff into pieces, refers to Israel being broken apart by the Romans in AD 70. We go now to Zechariah 11, verses 15 through 17, and we will finish this audio. And the Lord said to me, said to Zechariah, take again for yourself the equipment of a foolish shepherd. For behold, I am going to raise up a shepherd in the land who will not care for the perishing, seek the scattered, heal the broken, or sustain the one standing, but will devour the flesh of the fat sheep and tear off their hoofs. Woe to the worthless shepherd who leaves the flock. A sword will be on his arm and on his right eye. His arm will be totally withered, and his right eye will be blind. Now in verse 15, Yahweh tells Zechariah to take up the equipment of a foolish shepherd. Here's some examples of what a foolish shepherd might use. How about a staff without a hook? The hook is to grab the sheep by the neck. If it doesn't have a hook, it's no good. You'd have to be a stupid shepherd to have such a staff. How about a bag without bread? You take a bag into the field so you have some lunch to eat, and all of a sudden there's no bread in it. That's pretty stupid. Now this foolish shepherd is symbolic of the religious leaders during Jesus' day, most probably. In verse 16, Yahweh says, I'm going to raise up a shepherd. So Zechariah is representing this shepherd that's going to be raised up. He's going to be walking around like an idiot shepherd. And again, this might be in the vision, and he tells people later about what he's doing in the vision, or he might be actually doing it on the ground. And God says that Zechariah is going to symbolize the shepherd, the bad shepherd, the evil shepherd who will not care for the Israelites. Now, this bad shepherd is going to be raised up in punishment for the rejection of the good shepherd, Jesus. Who is this evil shepherd that's raised up? Three options. Option number one, the Antichrist, the future Antichrist. The pulpit commentator acknowledges that many commentators believe that, but the pulpit commentary denies that. Quote, the character of shepherd does not suit his attributes as given elsewhere, the attributes of the Antichrist. At any rate, this cannot be the primary reference of the symbol, though all evil powers that oppose the Church of Christ are in some sense images and anticipations of Antichrist. By the way, this is one of my favorite pet peeves. The New Testament only has one place where there is a possibility of there being a future Antichrist. All the other places where you see Antichrist or the Antichrist, it's obvious that the Scripture is referring to people in the times of the writer. This is in 1 John. There is one place where John says the Antichrist is coming, but he doesn't say he's coming 2,000 plus years afterwards. He could have been coming in his own lifetime. And writers like to identify the sea beast of Revelation and the man of sin in 2 Thessalonians 2 as the future Antichrist. But that's just an assumption. It's an assumption I don't hold. So I'm going to scratch option number 1 to say that this evil shepherd is the future Antichrist. Now here's option number 2. This is from Joseph Benson. Quote, the worthless shepherd, quote, denotes a succession of such shepherds as are described in the following words. In other words, a succession of shepherds who leave the flock, who devour their flesh, and tear off their hoofs. Now, Benson holds to this view. The pulpit commentary holds to this view. Who are some examples of such evil shepherds? Option number 1, scribes, Pharisees, and priests of Jesus' time. Option number 2, tyrannical political rulers over Israel, the bad kings. Option number 3, the false prophets and false messiahs Jesus mentioned in the Olivet Discourse. Now, Colin Delitzsch denies that this worthless shepherd is a succession of evil shepherds. Here's a quote from Colin Delitzsch. That we are not to understand by this foolish shepherd, the worthless shepherd, all the evil native rulers of the Jewish people collectively, as Hengstenberg supposes, is as evident from the context as it possibly can be. Colin Delitzsch are pretty strong that that's not the right option. So here's option number 3. The evil shepherd is the Roman Empire after AD 70, because the Romans will then rip the Jews apart, which they did. Colin Delitzsch holds to that view. The pulpit commentator says that many consider that the worthless shepherd symbolizes the Romans. But the pulpit commentary denies that by saying this, quote, these people could not be deemed to exercise pastoral care over the Israelites, nor could their neglect of this pastoral care be attributed to them as a sin, as it is in these verses, nor again did their destruction follow upon the overthrow of the Jewish polity. In other words, verse 17, when God says, woe to the worthless shepherd, that means that this worthless shepherd is sinning. And then when it says a sword will be on his arm and on his right eye, that means he's going to get whacked. His arm will be totally withered and his right eye will be blind. When did that happen to the Romans? I think that's a pretty telling objection that the pulpit commentary raises. So I'm going to take the option that the worthless shepherd denotes a succession of lousy shepherds the Israelites have had over time, especially in Jesus' time. The scribes, the Pharisees, the priests, and so forth, the Sanhedrin, the political rulers, the Sadducees, the false prophets, the false messiahs. Now there's an objection to that, because the worthless shepherd is singular in verse 17, woe to the worthless shepherd. But I could take it this way, woe to the worthless shepherd who happens to be in charge at this time. He's just a representative. Now if you take that view, the worthless shepherd is destroyed. A sword will be on his arm and on his right eye, because the Romans wiped him out in AD 70. And so, ladies and gentlemen, we have now finished our discussion of Zechariah chapter 11. We are prepared now to go to Zechariah chapter 12 in our next audio, which I will entitle, Him Whom They Have Pierced. I hope you stick around for that discussion, and I hope you enjoyed this audio.